I'm an advocate for a solution or a package of solutions that's going to do the whole job. So as you quite rightly pointed out, we've got to get rid of coal.
Yep.
And we're also going to have to get rid of oil and gas. I mean, yep. Oil's running low already. We're probably past the point of world peak production in oil, so it's all downhill from here.
Okay.
And we've got a bit more gas reserves left, but not a lot if we start to use that as our major source of energy other than coal. And, of course, gas is still a heavily polluting fossil fuel. It produces particulate pollutions when you combust it, nitrates, which form nitrous oxide and cause greenhouse problems. And it still releases about half of the carbon dioxide of coal. So that's if you burn a lot of gas, you're going to release a lot of CO2. So it's not a climate solution. None of the fossil fuels are. We've got to get off that.
Yep.
So the alternative solutions have got to be low carbon, as yep. you pointed out. And you either have to totally reconfigure the way we generate energy and the way we demand energy, or you need to develop solutions that can sort of work with the current system. But be a low-carbon solution. And so that's the difference I see between renewable energy and nuclear power.
Right.
I'm not saying that there is no role for renewable energy, but I doubt very much it's going to have the primary role in decarbonising our economy.
Right.
So nuclear power is a bit of a bugbear amongst most environmentalists.
Especially in Australia.
Yes, especially in Australia. But there are a number of strong environmental advocacy groups internationally as well, which are opposed to nuclear power. Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth.
Right.
The list goes on. In fact, it's hard to think of any environmental activist organisation that supports nuclear power. So you've got to ask, well, are there good reasons for that?
You know, okay.
Is there a sensible reason for rejecting nuclear power, which most advocates would acknowledge is a low carbon energy source, although some will even try and argue against that. But why do they object to it? Well, you need to understand a bit about the history of nuclear power and a bit about what current nuclear power does and what the future may offer. And
right.
So we're here today to talk about fourth generation nuclear power, which I'll try and explain in enough detail for people to get a bit of a hang of what that's all about. But you need to consider where we've come from. Of course, there was a first generation, a second, a third generation. The first generation nuclear power was the experimental reactors that were developed essentially at the same time as they were developing the atomic bomb in the 1940s. So they needed to have a way of creating plutonium.
Yep.
That was one of the ideas for creating a bomb. The other one was to enrich uranium. And to do that, they worked out how to build a reactor to create plutonium from uranium. And they're able to make bombs that they dropped on Japan on that, and then later start the nuclear proliferation between the US and Russia that formed a major part of the Cold War. Now, the second generation reactors were essentially the first commercial reactors. So after they developed these research reactors to create material for nuclear weapons, there was a simultaneous push to develop reactors for the nuclear navy. So they wanted reactors that could power large ships like aircraft carriers and also submarines. Submarines
yeah.
was the big key because they wanted to run these things under the ocean for days or months at a time. You can't do that when you've got to burn something in a power plant. You've got to have oxygen then. So there was a big motivation to do that. And essentially, once they perfected that technology in the 1950s, they beached a reactor from a submarine on land. You know, they just whacked it on land at a place called Shipping Port, and they developed the first commercial nuclear power plant. And then for the next 20-odd years, these were developed worldwide. These are the Generation 2 reactors. In the last decade or two, there's been an evolutionary design in nuclear power plants where they've improved safety systems. They've become more integral to the plant rather than being added on incrementally, as was done in the 60s and 70s. They've become more modularized, so they're cheaper to build. A standardized design so that rather than having a different plan for each nuclear power plant you build, you have a design where all the components can be built in a factory and then taken to site and so on. That's what's being deployed right now. So that's the reality, the current reality. Places like Asia, for instance, are really going big on this. China's
right.
building 15 of these reactors. Japan's built a couple in the last few years. South Korea, India, they're all pushing forward on these.
This is what we call third generation.
It's what we call third generation.
Yep.
Sometimes you'll hear it called generation 3+, which is
right.
like a little bit of an advance on what we're currently deploying right now. So
okay.
it's like what's coming in the next few years.
Right.
But fourth generation nuclear power, most analysts would say, well, that's coming in 20 years, say.
Okay.
15 or 20 years. The technology itself isn't that new. Most of it's been developed over the last 50 years. But in terms of deploying a commercial technology, realistically, it's going to be 10 to 20 years before we're starting to get these rolling off the production line.
Yep. Okay. So, well, what we'll go through is maybe just some of the main objections a lot of the green groups raise to nuclear power. We'll get to them specifically. I'll just kind of chronologically. First of all, we have to mine uranium. Mm-hmm. Will we have enough uranium? There's dangers inherent just in having a nuclear facility running, accidents we're talking about, weapons proliferation, that material that you have. Not only can it maybe be used for weapons, but it's also a waste, and how you get rid of that. So maybe, yeah, if we want to start with mining the uranium, this obviously won't be talking about fourth generation nuclear power, but one of the, and I see this as a pretty major strike against nuclear power. You have to mine uranium, mill it, enrich it, construct and decommission these power plants. I mean, do you see this as, you obviously see that this is okay. Do you want to just explain why?
Well, the primary concern with the uranium fuel cycle is that because it's energy intensive in certain parts of it, you obviously got to get that energy from somewhere, and mostly it comes from diesel, for instance, and other fossil fuels. But that's actually true of any form of new energy generation technology that we're deploying right now. To build a large nuclear power plant, you've got to use a lot of concrete and steel, for instance. For a 1 gigawatt plant, which is a pretty large plant, it's like the very large coal-fired power plants we have right now, you'd probably need around 300,000 tons worth of concrete to build a plant. So it's quite a lot. But you can only ever make sense of these numbers by looking at a life cycle analysis. So you look at the total amount of energy that any power plant would generate.
Right.
And then you look at the amount of energy that's gone into producing that power in the first place. And then when you can levelize all of that, you can work out, well, what's the benefit of technology A versus technology B. So when you do that, you come up with some quite surprising numbers. I mean, even wind power, for instance, which of course generates essentially no emissions once it's creating electricity, you still need to build very large turbines. So these huge steel structures over 100 meters tall with a large concrete base. In fact, you find the average wind turbine uses about 11 times more steel and concrete per megawatt generated than a nuclear power plant.
Right.
So they've all got their embedded emissions as well. Of course, once you're generating from a wind turbine, you're not mining or milling anything, so you've got less CO2 emissions there. So the only way to do it sensibly is a life cycle analysis, and there are some people who spend their whole careers doing this. And there's a really good group at the University of Sydney called the Sustainable Energy Group who do this. And they've found that when you look at the whole life cycle, the CO2 emissions, or the equivalent, so the amount of energy that goes into nuclear power, is around 60 grams per per kilowatt. So that doesn't really mean a lot in itself, but unless you compare it to something else. So coal, for instance, is somewhere between 900 and 1,200 grams per kilowatt. Okay, so nuclear is 60. Gas, the best combined cycle gas, is around 400 to 600 grams. Wind is around 40, and solar photovoltaics is around 150. So nuclear power and life cycle analysis uses about a third of the energy inputs of solar photovoltaics and is around the same as wind. So the argument that the mining and milling and enrichment and the whole life cycle, which is what you have to take account of here, is a carbon intensive activity, is clearly false.
Okay.
It's been shown by rigorous academic study, many different research groups, that the only way to look at this is with life cycle analysis. And when you do that, you find that nuclear power is as low a carbon energy source as wind or solar or the other low carbon energy sources that we're thinking of deploying, such as tidal or wave or geothermal.
Sure. Okay. No, excellent. Maybe while we're still talking about getting the uranium out of the ground, for what you envision this to be, well, actually, first of all, I just ask you whether you envision this to be really quite a long-term solution, or whether it's just kind of like an intermediate, you know, for now to stop the coal, and then whether we can get on to solar, wind as that technology progresses.
Yeah, that, no, that's a really good point. That the amount of nuclear power that you end up deploying and the rate at which you do it will depend a lot on how long it's going to last.
So yeah.
If we've got a generation worth of uranium left, let's say another 40 or 50 years, then given that the lifespan of nuclear power plants is around 60 years, there doesn't really seem a lot of point in pushing this in a big way if we're going to run out of uranium. That's quite a reasonable argument to mount. On the other hand, if there is enough nuclear fuel to make it last for much longer, then it would be quite an obvious solution. The great advantage of nuclear power from an energy perspective is that nuclear energy is extremely concentrated. We think of energy in carbon locked up in coal or in oil. That's a very concentrated form of stored energy, essentially stored ancient sunlight. Well, the energy stored in the atom is about 2 million times more concentrated than the energy stored in the chemical bonds of coal, which in and of itself is many thousands of times more concentrated than sunlight, for instance, that you have to harvest directly. So it's a conveniently concentrated energy store. So if we can make use of it, then it has a lot of big advantages. But if it's going to run out, then obviously it doesn't. So one of the big arguments against nuclear power has been we have estimated the uranium reserves, and right now the best estimate is that secured resources are about 5 million tons of uranium worldwide, and we know that there's probably about another 15 million tons that we can access at a reasonable cost, less than $150 a kilogram of uranium. So you could work out that with current generation technology, if we were to power the whole world by that nuclear power, so meet all of our power needs by third generation nuclear power, we would use up all of that uranium in the next 100 years or so, perhaps less. It really does depend on how much extra uranium we can mine efficiently. When you're talking about minerals, there's always a lot more of it than you can ever access, and that's true of oil or coal even.
Yeah.
When we run out of oil, there's not like there's going to be no oil left in the ground. It's that the amount of oil you can get out will be...
it's not worth it.
It's not worth it, yeah. Essentially, the energy you have to put in to get it out is greater than the energy you'll derive from burning.
Okay.
And once you do that, it's not an energy source anymore. You'd have to have other reasons for getting out. Coal is another good example that there's a lot of coal out there that we'll never dig up, even if there was no climate change problem, because it's so deep that the amount of energy to try and get the stuff out would be would mean the payback is not economically worth it.
Sure.
So with uranium, if you use current generation technology, then yeah, we would run out within the next 50 to 100 years if we went really big on nuclear power.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe just shifting a little bit. You did actually mention nuclear power was seen as kind of a bogeyman, perhaps. And I think one of the main reasons is possibility of accidents. I don't think we were able, as I understand it. So as we're moving up these generations, we're getting safer in terms of how the nuclear process works. Do you want to talk about specifically fourth generation, how safe it's going to be compared with previous generations, whether that's still a concern? Because that, I think if most people, if you ask them, that's going to be their number one concern, safety of nuclear power.
Mm. Well, people are really concerned about a few events that have occurred in nuclear power's history that have been dramatic. The most consequential, of course, is Chernobyl.
Mm.
So back in 1986, you had that reactor in Russia, which blew its top, had a graphite fire that released all of this radioactive material and sent a plume over Europe, which was the biggest disaster in nuclear power, one of the biggest disasters in terms of cost and public concern of any energy generation technology. Directly killed over 50 people, and been estimated up to 4,000 people got thyroid cancer as a result of that initial burst. Most of that was curable, but nevertheless, you'd rather not have got thyroid cancer. And then there is a lot of debate about the long-term effects in terms of elevating cancer rates on the radiation that persists. And medically speaking, there's not a lot of evidence that there are any more cancers, but basically, you don't want to have another Chernobyl. And you can debate all you want about how much radiation deaths are ultimately going to result from it. You don't want to have that happen again. So if you've got a decent prospect that that's going to happen in the future by deploying much more nuclear power, then we've got a problem. We essentially can't do it. Now, if you look at the number of people who die each year from digging up coal or mining and shipping oil and gas, then it's a huge number, far more than the number of people who have ever been killed in nuclear power. Hundreds of people each year die as a result of those energy generation technologies. We've had 50 direct deaths from Chernobyl nuclear power ever. And then there are a lot of indirect deaths in terms of pollution caused by fossil fuels. So it's been estimated around 25,000 people per year die prematurely as a result of respiratory illnesses in America alone, and perhaps up to 1 million people in China each year, just as a result of burning coal.
Yeah.
So any energy generation technology is going to have its side effects. But, of course, if we can do it all with energy technologies that kill the fewest number of people, then that's obviously the preferred way to do it. So the biggest accident ever in nuclear power was Chernobyl, and yet that was an accident which should never have happened.
Yeah.
The type of reactor that was used was one that could run out of control like that, and no Western reactor ever could. So even the accident that occurred at Three Mile Island, which was certainly the highest profile accident that ever happened in a Western nuclear reactor in 1979, the accident that happened didn't kill anyone, but more importantly, it wasn't the same type of accident that happened at Chernobyl. It wasn't the result of a runaway nuclear reactor. It was the result of some melting fuel after the reactor shut off. Okay, so there are technical reasons as to why Chernobyl could never happen in the West. But one of the interesting reasons is that every nuclear reactor in the West has, or in the developed world, has a containment dome, a big concrete shell over the top of it, so that if you have a problem, it's all contained within that. And Three Mile Island had one too. Chernobyl didn't have one. So as soon as you had a problem with the reactor, it was able to spew all of this material directly out into the atmosphere. Not a good thing.
Okay.
So you definitely want to have a containment dome on all of these reactors, which all Western reactors have. But you also want to have systems that are known as passive or inherent safety systems. And they're systems that are not dependent on human operators to allow them to work, or even on automated control systems. They're dependent on the laws of physics for them to operate. So these are called passive or inherent safety systems. Now, the Generation 3 technologies have plenty of these. I mean, right to the point where you have emergency cooling tanks that the valve is held closed by electrical power.
Okay.
So if you lose electrical power, you don't have to turn on the pumps to allow it to happen. It's gravity-fed. It will flow through automatically. You know, so that's one example of a passive safety system where it actually requires no human intervention to work. In most of the fourth generation designs, and certainly the ones which are getting most support, they have even deeper inherent safety systems that have actually been thoroughly tested experimentally. So the experimental breeder reactor, which was the exemplar of fourth generation nuclear power, went through exactly the same accident circumstances as Chernobyl and as Three Mile Island as a test. And they did them both in a day. And essentially they put the reactor through that situation and it calmly shut itself down.
Okay.
And then they put it through the second situation and it calmly shut itself down, and then they just restarted it again. Because safety systems operate in such a way that essentially as the coolant in the nuclear power plant got too hot, it caused the reaction to shut off. In technical terms, it lost criticality. So the reaction could no longer proceed. It was no longer a nuclear reaction. It was just hot fuel.
Okay.
And then because of the type of coolant, it's a liquid metal coolant that surrounds it, it was able to passively take away heat. So the water boils into steam and you've got to keep it in a pressurized vessel. In these reactors, you don't. It's just passive convection that can keep it away. So it's a real science to work out what the probabilities of these sort of accidents are. It's called probabilistic risk assessment. And it's essentially the same sort of principles that apply in many fields of engineering and science, from the bridges that are built and right through to assessment of physical models of climate change. They all use the same sort of principles. And a probabilistic risk assessment for third generation reactors is that you'll have one incident of the severity of Three Mile Island. so one that might destroy the reactor core but not release any radiation, roughly once every 29 million reactor years. So that means you would have to be running either 29 million reactors for a year or 10,000 reactors for 40,000 years before you'd have another one of those accidents. And then the Generation 3 technologies have an accident rate of about once every 430 million years. So essentially 10,000 reactors powering the world, you'd have an accident about once every three ice ages.
Right. Okay. Well, how about... Okay, because I know you did talk about coal power stations, how there's obviously inherent danger there with pollution. I think there's also the perception of that kind of more like banal danger rather than an accident happening with a nuclear power station. You know, there's a nuclear power station on the hill. I'm living next door to it. Is there any kind of studies... want to talk about, the dangers of...
Even thermal power plants that use fossil fuels have a risk of the boiler exploding, for instance.
Yeah.
And, or there was an example in the United States a few years ago of a tailings dam for coal sludge and fly ash that broke and flooded this area and suffocated a whole bunch of people. You know, these accidents also happen at your local coal-fired power station. As I said, there's no safer power generation system than nuclear power plants. If you have a risk of an accident that could kill you of once every 30 million reactor years, then that's about as secure as you're ever going to get in this life. So I would much more happily live next to a nuclear power station than a coal-fired or gas-fired power station.
Okay. Changing just once again, how about we talk about the risk of proliferation of nuclear weapons? I think, as I understand it, although I'm not sure this is entirely correct. Oh, no, actually, I don't think it is. Maybe we'll just talk about nuclear weapons generally, because this is another huge objection that people bring up against any kind of nuclear program for energy, possibility of use in weapons. And especially if you're talking about this as an international solution to climate change, not just, say, in Australia. There are going to be, I mean, for instance, Iran is developing a nuclear weapons program. They're not developing a nuclear weapons program, a nuclear energy program.
Mm-hmm.
People are concerned they will develop a nuclear weapons program. Is this in any way addressed by fourth generation nuclear power? Or
It can be addressed partially by the technology itself.
Yeah.
And then partially by the international political regime we have in place. Okay. And also partially by a deference to history. You can look at what's actually happened and what's likely. So if you look at the nuclear club, I think it's around eight nations have nuclear weapons.
Right.
The largest being the US and United States. Sorry, the United States and Russia and China, India, Pakistan. You know, these are the main ones. And then there is a bunch of 30-odd nations that have nuclear power and don't have any nuclear weapons. So they've had nuclear power industries running for years or decades.
Right.
And have never developed nuclear weapons. In fact, there's no evidence that nuclear power reactors for generating electricity were ever used to generate bombs. But, of course, once you develop the expertise to work a nuclear power reactor, you've developed much of the same sort of expertise you'd ultimately need to develop a nuclear weapon.
Right.
So there is a risk that as you spread the expertise for running nuclear power reactors, you also increase the expertise for developing a bomb.
Yep.
So there are two other ways to look at it. One is that you can develop nuclear power technologies that are called inherently proliferation resistant.
Yep.
That means you have to go to extraordinary lengths to convert these from something that cannot make a bomb to something that can. And the other way you can do it is by having a robust international regime, such as the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and the Non-Proliferation Treaty and so on.
Right.
And one of the motivations for developing nuclear weapons in the past by those few nations who have done it is that they've been insecure, that for one reason or another they've felt sufficiently threatened to invest very large amounts of money into developing a nuclear weapons program. I mean, the classic case is Pakistan, for instance, which was left in a situation where actually first India developed nuclear weapons as a response to border conflicts with China.
Yep.
And in Pakistan, having border conflicts with India, felt they had to develop nuclear weapons to match that arms race. there are other circumstances such as Iran today, which are in much of the same situation. They feel threatened by nuclear Israel, for instance, and they want to defend themselves. I think whether or not you've got nuclear power existing in the world, and whether a country has that or not, is going to play a very minor part in whether a nation takes that decision to develop a nuclear weapon anyway. And of course, for all of the nations that already have nuclear weapons, or have nuclear power, the argument of the spread of the technology is essentially moot, because they've already got that technology anyway.
Yeah.
So the genie's out of the bottle, if you want to put it that way. So if you tally up all of the carbon emissions for all the nations that already have nuclear weapons, then you capture about 70% of all the world's carbon emissions. If you capture those that have nuclear weapons and nuclear power, you're getting closer to 90% of all carbon emissions. So if you want to keep it out of those last 10% by various ways, then that's an argument you've got to fight on various terms. But it's not going to do a lot to avoid what people worry about with proliferation. But the other thing you can do is, as I said, develop technologies that are inherently proliferation resistant. Now, one of the most proliferation prone technologies is recycling by a method called Purex. And Purex was developed initially for the bomb program in the US, for the Manhattan Project, and it's designed to separate out plutonium. Okay. So you create plutonium in your reactor and you separate pure plutonium that's butte for making nuclear bombs. The other way to do it is to develop enrichment technology, where you can enrich uranium to make a bomb.
Mm.
Now, if you can develop reprocessing technology that doesn't separate out uranium, and you can eliminate the need to enrich uranium, then you've hit on the head two of the major technological pathways for even developing a bomb in the first place. So the great advantage of fourth generation nuclear power is that it doesn't require any uranium enrichment, so you've cut off that pathway, and it doesn't require any separation of plutonium from all of the other, they're called transuranics, but these other elements that make it essentially impossible to make a bomb out of this material. So if you can develop those technologies along with a sensible international regime, then I think the chances in the future of nuclear proliferation are actually greatly reduced by developing and promoting these technologies rather than enhancing it. But if you don't believe that, then you allow the 90% of the world that's already got nuclear technology to continue to develop it.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe rather, I think we'll just move on to the last major point here, that's an objection to nuclear power, which is what you have to do with the waste.
Mm.
Is, again, I'll just start by asking whether what the difference is between the fourth generation and previous generations, and if you just want to talk about nuclear waste.
Yeah, this is an important point because it also comes back to that earlier question we had about how much uranium is out there.
Mm.
Uranium or thorium, you can also use thorium in some reactors. Now, if we use current generation nuclear power, we're going to run out of uranium and thorium within a century or so. If we use it as a major solution for climate change and deployed it as essentially the major technology for generating energy, that's not good. But a huge advantage of these fourth generation reactor technologies is that they use uranium and thorium incredibly efficiently. So right now we get about 1%, less than 1% of the energy out of uranium. Less than 1%. We throw the rest away. We throw that away in the form of spent fuel, and that's considered nuclear waste. But in fact, if you have the technology to continue to reprocess that waste and make use of all of the energy in uranium, then ultimately you can get about 160 times more energy than we're currently getting out of nuclear power. And that means that the amount of uranium that we've already mined is enough to power all the world in nuclear power by these fast reactors for around 700 years.
Right.
And then the amount of uranium that we've already discovered and could mine at less than $150 a kilogram will be enough to power the world for about 50,000 years. And then the amount of uranium that's available in lower quality ores, which would be carbon intensive or energy intensive to access right now, but if we're running an all-electric society on nuclear power in the future, there's no carbon emissions. So you can continue to access that. Or indeed, you can get it out of seawater as well. Then there's essentially enough nuclear power to run the world for billions of years.
Right.
So there's enough nuclear fuel with fourth generation technology to run the world forever. And the big advantage of it is that the initial result of large-scale deployment of these nuclear technologies would be you would use up all of the currently existing nuclear waste.
Yeah.
So all of that long-lived nuclear waste that we have to right now manage for 10 to 100,000 years would become the fuel, the energy source of these new reactors.
Okay.
And so what you're left with then is the true nuclear waste, and that is the result of splitting uranium atoms into smaller atoms. And that's what nuclear power is. It's a fissioning of large atoms into smaller ones. Those smaller ones are intensely radioactive when they're first created. Most of them quickly decay away into nothing within a few days or a few weeks. A couple of them last with a half-life of 30 years. And those ones, you want to wait about 10 half-lives in order for it to be below the background level of radiation of the original ores that it came from. So after about 300 years of managing this waste, you're back to a radioactivity level that is the same or less than the rocks that currently exist around Roxby Downs where people are living.
Right.
So you haven't no longer have got a 10,000 to 100,000 year waste problem. You've got a waste management issue of around 300 years. And because you're using much more of the energy in it, so you're only taking a small proportion out that you used to take, you've also got less than a tenth of the waste remaining. So a current generation nuclear reactor will require about 160 tons worth of mined uranium per year, and then that's enriched to the point where you can create the fuel, which takes about 25 tons of uranium a year, and that results in about 25 tons of high-level nuclear waste that you have to manage. The fourth generation reactors will consume all of that past waste that we built up, and then it will require about a ton of uranium per year without enrichment, and it will produce about a ton of these fission products as a result. So incredibly, so to put it in perspective, someone could hand you a ping pong ball sized lump of uranium, which is a metal. That would be enough energy within that to power all of your energy needs for all of your lifetime. And that includes all of your electricity use, so, you know, all of your appliances, all of the energy that goes into growing your food, all of the energy that will go into running your car, to creating synthetic fuel for jets, whatever. The whole thing within that ping pong ball worth of, and that's the amount of waste that you would produce in your lifetime as a result of your energy generation. So enough, there's enough uranium to power all of the world's population for millions of years when you're using that small amount of uranium, and the amount of waste is trivial and you only have to manage it for a few hundred years. So you can see the nuclear waste problem actually goes hand in hand with the uranium supply problem. You can simultaneously solve both of those problems by using fourth generation nuclear power. It's not a theoretical technology that's never been deployed. In fact, it's been developed over the last 50 years. The first ever nuclear power reactor was what people consider this fourth generation technology. It's called a fast spectrum reactor.
Right.
A reactor that can actually breed more fissile fuel, so more burnable fuel than it actually starts with. These are the power technologies of the future for nuclear power, and it's a matter of taking it from the experimental stage through to the full-scale commercialization stage.
Now, Barry, previously we were just talking about some of the main objections to nuclear power and how you see that's kind of mitigated or addressed by fourth generation nuclear power, and how we kind of will need this technology to combat climate change, come away from a coal, oil, gas energy infrastructure. Perhaps we should just talk about the time frame of what you're talking about right now, because I think, yeah, we really need to, I mean, like you said before, this needs to be commercialized. Kind of come off the page or out of labs. I mean, do you, or you obviously think that this will be in time to avert some sort of climate change catastrophe?
Yeah, that's an important question, and it's a question I'm most often asked by concerned environmentalists is, well, even if all of these great benefits of fourth generation nuclear power are correct and that the technology is able to be commercialized on a scale that's sufficient, aren't we going to run out of time? You know, isn't climate change such an urgent issue already that we've got to deploy the technologies that we have commercially available now as fast as possible to try and cut our emissions? Now, that's a complex issue. If you look at the climate science, then the biggest contributor to the enhanced greenhouse effect and to future global warming is carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is a long-lived greenhouse gas. And it's a legacy that will be with us for thousands of years. So what ultimately matters is not actually whether we cut the emissions this year or next year or in the next 5 years. What matters is the total amount of carbon dioxide we end up putting up there,
right,
up into the atmosphere, because it's going to hang around there for so long. So if we are able to achieve a total decarbonisation of our economy, say, by 2050, and we're able to do that through the deployment of a combination of third-generation nuclear power today and fourth generation within the next decade to 3 decades, and we're able to achieve that, then we've achieved the same end result as if we were able to have a pathway starting now with renewable energy to somehow get to the same point in 2050. The difference could be the amount of emissions that we're releasing in the next 10 and 20 years, but what ultimately matters is the cumulative emissions, so the total amount of carbon that we put up there between 2010 and 2050. And if you come up with a scenario that can decarbonize our energy supply by 2050 and is competitive in terms of economics and also competitive in terms of reducing those emissions, then you've got a solution.
Okay.
So fourth generation nuclear power, there's no commercial reactors available today. There has been in the past, in fact. It wasn't called fourth generation nuclear power, but the Russians had developed a sodium-cooled fast reactor, which was one of these design technologies, and ran it successfully for 30-odd years as a desalination and electricity generation plant. The French ran one for about 35 years as well. The Chinese are building a couple right now, and the Indians are also building a couple. So they're starting to come on board. But the true systems design that represents the exemplar of these has been developed in the US.
Right.
And there's two different types of designs, and these are the ones that need to be fully commercialized. And that's going to be a process that's going to take anywhere from 10 to 15 years, I suspect. So in the interim, what we're seeing right now is a lot of coal continuing to be deployed, a lot of wind power starting to be built.
Yeah.
That's the main renewable energy technology that's being deployed right now. A little bit of token solar, but not much is happening right now. And a lot of nuclear power that's being deployed. So there's the fossil fuels that continue to roll out at a large rate, which we've got to stop that happening and start to roll that back quickly, likely decommissioning coal-fired power stations before they're ready to retire. And then we've got nuclear power stations, third-generation nuclear power stations, that are rolling out at a fair clip in Asia and starting to be taken up again in Europe. A lot of discussion in the US, but no decision as to how fast they should roll those out. Well, ultimately, when you look at it, you can design an energy plan, essentially, that continues to roll out third-generation nuclear power at a fair clip now and gradually brings in more and more fourth-generation nuclear power, such that in the next 10 years we may build 95% of Generation 3 nuclear power plants, and then in the decade after that we may build 10% of them being fourth generation, and then the decade after that 50% of them fourth generation, and by the time you got to 2050, you can have a scenario where the world is powered by nuclear power, a mix of Generation 3 and Generation 4.
Mm.
You're only ever building Generation 4 nuclear power from then on, but essentially you've got there. You've got to a decarbonised economy, and you've got there through a synergy, a mix between Generation 3 and Generation 4. As one ramps up initially and then starts to decline, as the other one ramps up and takes up the rest of the role. Now, if you didn't have the prospect of Generation 4 nuclear power, as we discussed earlier, there wouldn't be a lot of point in rolling out Generation 3 at such a large scale, because you would have a lot of long-lived waste to deal with, which concerns a lot of people, so you'd have to develop many more geological repositories to deal with that, and you would ultimately be running short of nuclear fuel within 50 years or so. Not a good prospect. But you can't have a technology that acts alone. And what you've got to have is a technology that is able to build on past technologies and have a schedule that rolls out that ultimately reaches the endpoint that you want to reach, which is a decarbonised economy by 2050. And nuclear power can certainly do that, even if Generation 4 technology is 10 years off commercialisation. Because all of the nuclear waste that you're producing through these third generation plants, it's not nuclear waste, it's the fuel for the fourth generation nuclear plant.
Yeah.
Now people say, well, but what if by some extraordinary circumstance we never develop these, they don't work or something? Well, we know they work because we've used them in the past and they've undergone very successful testing programs. But if they didn't, then I think we've got rather larger problems than a bit of extra accumulated nuclear waste, because if they don't work, then we have got a lot of coal to deal with in the next 50 years, and that will create so many extra pollution issues that essentially I don't want to think about what the energy future would be as a result of that. Now, the technology is going to work, but it's a matter of having a synergy between those two technologies. Now, in terms of time frame, that's another important issue, that can we build enough nuclear power plants now, given that they might take 4 years to build a large nuclear reactor, and yet you could be putting down these wind turbines, for instance, pretty quickly.
Mm.
You could build a 100 megawatt wind farm in a year, say. I mean, that's been done in the past. So you can put a lot of these large turbines down fairly quickly. So surely then you can build these at a greater rate than you can your nuclear power stations. Well, the French showed in the 1970s and 80s, when they went from being a very minor player in terms of nuclear power generation to having almost all of their power generated by nuclear power, which continues today. Mm. About 80% of their power come from nuclear power. The French nation was building about 3.5 gigawatts of nuclear power per year at their peak, as they were replacing their coal and other fossil oil generation technology. Now, if you scaled it up, if you looked at the size of the French economy then and said, well, if you scale it up to the world economy today, how much could we build? We find we could actually build 300 to 500 gigawatts of nuclear power per year.
Okay.
Which means within about 30 years, you could completely replace fossil fuels as a result of that. Now, if you want to scale up to do the same with wind or solar, then the task doesn't become any smaller. The task remains huge.
Mm.
Ultimately, you'd have to build roughly 1,500 of those large skyscraper-sized wind turbines every day from 2010 to 2050 to replace coal. Or if you were going to do it through desert-based solar thermal, you would have to build the equivalent of 200 square meters of desert mirrors every second from 2010 to 2050. So whatever technology you decide to pursue, and ultimately one would suspect a whole range of technologies will be pursued, the challenge is huge.
Yeah.
And the challenge isn't diminished by the fact that you've chosen one technology over another. It's a big choice either way.
Mm.
But the myth that you can't deploy nuclear power fast enough because it takes 4 years to build a single reactor is clearly that. It's clearly a myth, because you build multiple reactors at the same time, and once you've built the reactor, it generates an enormous amount of power. It generates about... A decent-sized reactor is anywhere from 1 to 2 gigawatts of power, which is the equivalent of many hundreds of those smaller wind farms that you can deploy over a shorter time period.
Mm.
So when you look at the rollout schedule, you find it's actually easiest to achieve decarbonisation using nuclear power compared to renewable energy technologies, because not only can you build as fast in terms of the key metric that matters, which is energy delivered, but also it has many favourable characteristics that renewable energy doesn't have in terms of how well it is matched to the current way we use power and the way the developing world wants to use power. So if you look at a developing nation like China or India, they're going helter-skelter towards a higher energy economy. You know, the average Indian or Chinese uses far less energy than the average Australian, far less. And yet their ambition ultimately is to be using somewhere around the same energy. But even if they're using half the amount of energy an Australian uses, which is incidentally what the average European uses, so even if they're aspiring within the next few decades to get to the energy level of the average European, who tends to be more energy efficient than the average Australian, then it still involves something like a fivefold increase in the per capita rate of energy generation.
Mm.
And mostly they're doing that through the cheapest technology they can. The cheapest technology is coal.
Yeah.
They're not burning coal because they want to create these horrible smoggy cities and they want to create millions of deaths each year from respiratory illnesses. They're not doing it because they enjoy mining coal and having all the coal mining accidents and having half of their rail fleet dedicated to moving coal around the country. They're doing it because it's cheap. If you can develop a technology that's as cheap or cheaper than coal, I think you've got your best prospect of actually displacing it.
Yeah.
And I suggest that the best prospect for generating reliable baseload power in enormous volumes, concentrated in areas of industrial development and large-scale housing, so large cities, is nuclear power. Nuclear power is a sort of technology that can replace directly a coal-fired power station. Essentially, you can go to a site, you can rip out the coal burner, you can put in a reactor, you can even make use of much of the infrastructure, the transmission infrastructure,
yeah,
the cooling towers and so forth. You can replace coal directly with this. And there's essentially no other low-carbon technology that can possibly do that. My suspicion is that ultimately we will have most of our primary energy derived from nuclear power in one way or another, but there will be a role for wind and solar, and that role will be determined by the competitiveness of them in the market.
Okay.
I do despair that things like the Copenhagen Agreement, which is looking to cut carbon emissions by a considerable amount within the next few decades, is going to reach any satisfactory conclusion, because people are still talking about carbon cuts without talking about the technology that can actually achieve those cuts. And until you have a technology that will be embraced by developing nations such as China and India, who, whilst historically haven't been responsible for most of the emissions up in the air right now, will be in the future.
Mm.
Most of the emissions will, in the 21st century, will come from what we consider the developing world. Unless you can find a technology that economically, in the short term, makes sense for them to deploy rather than coal, I think you're going to face a real struggle to try and get them to decarbonise their economies in time.
Sure. Okay, Barry, we may just take a quick opportunity just in the last couple of minutes just to talk about the last time you were on this show, it was in April, talking about Ian Plimer's book, Heaven and Earth. I wonder if you want to talk about perhaps any changes you've maybe seen in the media landscape or the popular landscape in terms of how climate change is presented, perhaps the effect and kind of the pushing of Ian Plimer's book, especially in, for instance, The Australian, how that maybe looks as you look back on it?
Well, I think fundamentally society has become more polarised rather than less polarised over the last few years, as the prospect of a price on carbon, whether that be an emissions trading scheme or a straight carbon tax, whatever, becomes more likely. And the concern amongst groups on the one hand who are concerned about climate change and the runaway impacts that could invoke.
Yeah.
And those who are concerned about the damage we could do, or the perceived damage we could do to our economy as a result of putting extra prices on energy. And I don't think that concern is going to go away. But I think ultimately climate change is a symptom of an energy problem,
okay,
a fundamental energy problem. Now, it's a severe symptom.
Mm.
But whether or not you're concerned about climate change as being the primary problem associated with burning fossil fuels or not, there are other problems associated with them. There's a limited supply of oil and gas, most of which is imported into our country.
Yep.
We would rather... I mean, there's a lot of gas still available, but we're planning to export a lot of that as LNG, and that also produces a lot of fossil fuel. But if we were to generate all of our power from gas in Australia, shut down all that coal, just do it with gas, we'd run out of gas in the next few decades.
Okay.
It's not a long-term solution anyway. So if we're going to have long-term planning, we can't rely on our gas, irrespective of its carbon emissions, which are very large.
Okay.
We've got enough domestic coal to power our economy for the next few centuries. But of course, when you burn coal, not only do you release carbon dioxide, but you release a whole bunch of other pollutants. It causes acid rain, soot that causes respiratory diseases. Heck, even uranium and thorium is released from the combustion of coal.
Yeah.
Much more than you would ever release from a nuclear power station. In fact, you can measure that the amount of uranium and coal released from burning, uranium and thorium released from burning coal is about 100 times that released in the nuclear cycle.
Okay.
So there are many other reasons why we should be shedding ourselves of our dependence on these fossil fuels. And I think ultimately if you can get a solution that enables us to decarbonise our energy supply, but does so in a way that is beneficial to our long-term energy security, then you can have some agreement from what are right now quite polarised views as to whether we should do it. Because no one disagrees fundamentally that we're going to run out of fossil fuels, that they're a finite resource. No one fundamentally disagrees that they are unhealthy.
Yep.
But people fundamentally disagree about the rate at which we can develop alternative technologies and the economic cost of that.
Yeah.
So if we can have a bit more focus on the sort of technologies that can deliver multiple benefits, that can ultimately be cheaper than fossil fuels, be able to replace them, and to address these major environmental concerns, and I think we're on with a real winner. So I think the only way we're going to break this divide is to focus more on that aspect of the debate.